last thing I want to ask you about is whether there are any patients in your practice that you could present to me to try to give me a better idea of how you evaluate patients, how you integrate, you know, a clinical trial option.
Well, sure. I've got several patients like that. I have had a patient, unfortunately, a wonderful guy I saw in 2004, I'm thinking. I saw him with one of the fellows, and the fellow saw this patient and presented him to me and said, "You're going to love this patient. He's perfect for your trial. He's totally buff, weightlifter, golfer." He was a 39-year-old drug representative, actually, a pharmaceutical sales rep who had been treated for seminoma with radiation quite a number of years back. And in November of that year, had had pretty much normal counts. And I don't remember why he actually sought attention, but developed pancytopenia and a bone marrow suggestive of refractory anemia with excess blast with a very complex karyotype, which in retrospect also included 5q minus in addition to numerous other abnormalities. And he had a sister who was HLA disparate, and that was his only first degree relative, so transplant was going to be difficult. As it happens, we were unable to find an unrelated donor for him either. So I saw him in about June or July of that year, and we talked about azacitidine as an appropriate therapy for him, but our phase one trial with entinostat was hopefully about to begin, we thought by September. And he was a pretty smart dude and was feeling great and didn't really care to be treated over the summer because he wanted to be out golfing. So he said, "Look, you know, why don't we come back in the fall when your trial is open? I'd rather be on your trial." Well, between the NCI and our IRB, in fact, we didn't open up till November. And he comes back to start trial in November, still looks pretty good, but his counts are completely in the toilet. He has, you know, like 4,000 platelets, and he's got 50% blast in the bone marrow for sure with our rods. So he looks, for all the world, like bona fide AML at that point, and his karyotype has gotten much more complex. There were four different cytogenetic clones. And he was the first person treated on our phase one study. Our phase one study, actually our combination trials, have included a 10-day schedule of azacitidine that we developed in previous trials, 50 per meter squared times 10. And they get two doses of entinostat on days 3 and 10. As I mentioned to you before, this is a long-lived drug which can be given weekly. And we delay its administration until day 3 because of in vitro data suggesting the cells need to see the DNA methyltransferase inhibitor first if you want to get synergistic re-expression of genes. So he starts out on a very low dose of entinostat with 50 per meter of azacitidine for 10 days. He comes back a month later and he's got some thrush in his mouth, and that's fine. He was quite granulocytopenic before we started. And we put him on fluconazole or whatever we put him on, and comes back a little bit later and he's a little bit worse. We put him on caspofungin. Comes back a month later, quite ill. He's got nodular infiltrates in his lungs, quite sick, and ends up on ambisome. And, you know, I was really worried that my investigator had been on a little too tight. I certainly thought this guy would not likely respond to ARC-based therapy, but here's this young guy who's dying of fungal infection, giving some nonsense medicine on my clinical trial. So, and this buff guy ends up being discharged to subacute rehab, you know, that is a nursing home. His wife was quite a proactive, energetic woman and convinces the nursing home to let him get his fourth cycle of the experimental drugs at the nursing home she would administer because, you know, she knew that the fourth cycle was the minimum to see a clinical response. Sure enough, at the end of the fourth cycle, we start getting calls from the nursing home that his platelets seem to be coming up and everything's coming up. And he shows up to me, you know, looking like $1 million. His counts are normal. And he's, in fact, in a pathologic remission. And that complete remission was maintained for 2 years. Unfortunately, not longer than 2 years. During that period of time, you know, he was leading a very active life, was a really inspirational speaker for a bunch of patient advocacy groups for Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and so on, and a very inspirational character. We were, again, never able to find an appropriate transplant option. And then he subsequently did progress and unfortunately didn't respond to a number of therapies, including aggressive chemotherapy, and unfortunately passed away.
How did you see him in terms of, you know, it's interesting you talk about him becoming involved with advocacy, et cetera. What was the experience like for him at a personal level? What did you observe in him and his wife?
They were just remarkable. They were so upbeat, and I think part of it is his sales personality, but, you know, really until the very end, as he sort of was becoming more desperate and really were always very positive. And, you know, of course, I felt a little bad as he was getting worse and we were unable to intervene more positively. He had been on the featured on the cover article of one of Johns Hopkins kind of fundraising rags promises and something or other beautiful photo spread of him and his wife. And I felt like, you know, did we kind of manipulate them or use them in some way? But in fact, talking to his wife, they totally felt wonderful about being able to lead the way. And they really do feel that he would have been dead 3 years earlier without their opportunity to enroll in this clinical trial, which of course was a major benefit for him.
Now, I'm sure, I would guess he might have brought up to you the issue of his prior radiation therapy and the connection to this. What did you respond when he brought that up?
You know, it's really unknown. Radiation by itself certainly is not highly leukemogenic, but it's not totally non-leukemogenic. We know that from Hiroshima. So, you know, I guess the question would come, if there were a clinical trial that excluded secondary MDS, would you exclude him? And thinking of wearing my ECOG investigator hat, if a doc were to call me, I'd probably leave it in the physician's personal judgment phase. But I think at the end of the day, it's hard to exclude that it was a secondary MDS in this case.